Podcast of the cinema.
It sure is.
Sponsored by
I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk. Are we reading that off the top?
Why not?
Oh, okay. I thought we were gonna work that in midway through.
Why not? Well, we just hit them with it.
All right. Well,
we're gonna let the rhythm hit them.
You're Dave White.
Yeah.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
That's true.
A year and a half ago, a Linoleum Knife listener reached out to the LK Army. I don't know if I subscribe to that.
Are y'all an army?
We have not ever come up with a collective name for the listeners of this program.
But, formation. Yeah.
For their support in his effort to raise money to shoot his first feature film. And the LK Army responded. I'm a pacifist.
What if... Who like... Okay. Listeners, what should you... If you're subscribing, you're a club member.
True.
You're in the LK Club. We'll talk about that soon, too.
But, no doubt.
But all right. Yeah. If someone can think of something awesomer than an army, then tell us what you think it ought to be. For now,
a murder of LK listeners.
Listen. For now, here's a filmmaker who just paid us money
to call you an army
to do this ad. And his copy says Army.
So Army you are.
So for today, he's paid for the privilege of calling it the LK Army.
Right.
So today you're an Army.
And the LK Army responded. He raised the money and the film and... He raised the money, shot the film, and now, at long last, the movie is complete and will be screening at the glorious historic Vista Theater in Los Feliz.
That's a good theater.
Yeah. Lots of legroom. What movie? I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk. That's what movie.
Now, y'all have heard about that. Okay, maybe you haven't.
Long-time listeners will remember this.
Long-time listeners will remember that when I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk was getting its...
Was raising its capital. They reached out to you, our listeners,
yes,
for assistance in that regard.
That was a series of, again, paid advertisements.
Yes.
And we were happy to do it.
Were-Skunk tells the story of Curtis, a teenage boy in 1960s Leave It to Beaver America, who, after being sprayed in the face by an enchanted skunk, turns into a murderous were-skunk whenever he gets, well, horny.
So are these sex crimes? Does he murder after skunking them with sex?
And not having seen the film, I cannot say.
Hmm.
The film is a loving homage to the drive-in monster movies of the 50s and 60s, and it's sweet and funny and charming. Again, I'm reading this. And if you like things that are amazing, y'all should come out and see it.
Maybe he turns into a horny skunk.
Uh-huh. And starts talking like Pepe Le Pew.
Then has horny skunk sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bad people come along.
And he sprays them.
And he sprays them?
Mm-hmm. The screening will be at the Vista Theater on Tuesday night, May 3rd at 7 p.m. A one-night-only event. So don't miss out. Tickets will be available at the door, but you are encouraged to purchase them ahead of time to be safe, which you can do by visiting www.teenageweareskunk.com.
That's a URL.
www.teenageweareskunk.com.
Yeah,
like werewolf, were-skunk.
You should know how to spell were in the proper context, yeah.
He says, pause the podcast, go to the website, purchase your tickets, unpause the podcast, and continue to enjoy the dulcet tones of D-Money and A-Smooth.
D-Money.
And A-Smooth.
I like you as A-Smooth. I think... You know what?
But then people will think I'm related to J.B. Smooth.
He paid for the privilege of calling me D-Money.
Yes.
Technically, I am D-Money because I got his money.
That's true.
Yeah.
See ya at the Vista, he says. So you heard it here first. I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk, a movie that some of you helped to finance.
It's a completed film.
Is now a finished product and ready to be unspooled here in Los Angeles. Thank you, I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk, for your support of Linoleum Knife.
Indeed, we love advertisers. Also, we love subscribers, but we're not going to go. We're not going to hit you with two ads in a row.
No, we'll talk about club membership later.
This is because, not because I think I need to hammer you again with club membership, but I actually have questions for some of you. I'm confused by the Patreon activities of a handful of folks. And I want to make sure we're all clear on how things work. Yes.
Are we even on the same page here?
Yeah. But that'll come later.
Yes.
We're going to talk about movies.
Yes.
We have two large... Wait, did you see Criminal?
I did not.
Oh, neither did I.
No, so we're not
Success.
Talking about it. Success. Success. Those Three Stooges bits don't really work on audio.
They work for me.
Oh, right. There's a reason they never had a radio show.
Yeah.
We're talking about...
So you're not going to hear a review of Criminal because we don't care.
Two wide release films, one that's probably expanding and one that is probably a very small reissue.
What's the reissue?
Une Femme Mariée.
Oh. Well, let's just get Jungle Book out of the way first.
Okay. So... Jon Favreau directs, and it is another Disney remake of one of their animated films, which was in turn based on the Rudyard Kipling short stories. Yes. And, you know, the movie hits most of the beats of the 1967 animated version, but
Mowgli
much more seriously.
Becoming grown.
Yes.
Well, he's like 10.
Yeah.
But he's of an age... where he's no longer a little kid.
Yes.
And the wolves can no longer protect him from Shere Khan, the tiger.
Right.
Now, Shere Khan, the tiger, has a burnt-up face.
Because of Mowgli's dad.
He attacked Mowgli's dad. Mowgli's dad fought back with the red
torch.
The red flower.
The red flower, right.
It's fire. And then... Shere Khan killed him, but got his face burned in the process.
Mm.
He hates man.
Mm-hmm.
He hates Mowgli's father. Now he hates Mowgli. And he's coming for him. So, the wolves say, you have to go back to the man village. We know you think you're a wolf, but you are not, and you have to go to the man village. Bagheera the panther, voiced by...
Ben Kingsley,
and Wolf Mom, voiced by Lupita Nyong'o.
Right. Shere Khan, incidentally, voiced by Idris Elba.
The kid's name is Neil Seti.
Seti?
Yeah. They go off to the jungle. They're on their way to the man village. They get separated. Mowgli stumbles upon Baloo.
Well, first he meets up with Ka, the serpent.
Correct, yes. Ka, the giant boa constrictor, who is voiced by Scarlett Johansson. Baloo saves Mowgli from Ka.
Baloo is Bill Murray.
They go looking for the bare necessities. They forget about their worry and their strife.
Mm-hmm.
They run into King Louie. A gigantic... orangutan.
Yes.
Like bigger than Baloo.
Yes.
Was that part of the original story? Because,
I've never read the Kipling. In the cartoon
he's
not
just
that big.
Regular old orangutan.
Right.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken.
He wants to be like Mowgli. Mm-hmm. Sings a song about it.
Ooby-Doo.
Then... Fighting. So, yeah.
And a different ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I'll say.
Well, they want sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the surprise of this film, for me.
Wasn't there like a 90s live action Jungle Book?
Are you thinking of George of the Jungle with Brendan Fraser?
I am not. I'm thinking of a live action Disney 90s Jungle Book with like Jason Scott Lee or something. Hang on.
This is
Talk about
not.
this one. I gotta look this
I don't
up.
remember. Anyway, I'm watching the closing credits, and here's what I learned that I did not know before, because as you and I have discussed before, I live in the bubble of no pre-release information.
Sorry, yes. 1994
Yeah.
Disney live action movie with Jason Scott Lee as Mowgli. Directed by Stephen Sommers. This was, I'm surprised you didn't take the ASD kids to this movie.
For all I know, I did take them to see this and forgot every second of it.
Anyway, closing credits. You were stunned to learn.
There were nothing about this movie was shot outside.
Yes.
No, at no point were people outside in the in actual nature.
No sunscreen was harmed in the making of this film.
Yeah, this was shot entirely on sound stages in downtown Los Angeles,
yeah.
Which did really surprise me, and happily surprised me, because, as I just said, I have constructed my life so that I am pretty skilled at avoiding pre-release information,
Yeah, I did not know any of the details either.
production information, what's coming information.
The only reason I even saw half of the trailer of this movie was because we paid to see Zootopia
Yeah.
with regular folks.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I had kind of tuned out as well. Yeah, and so all the more for its complete artificiality, I found it as immersive as Avatar. I tried to get you to see it in 3D, but you were not having it. But
No.
this is a movie I actually was telling people, no, really, see it in 3D because you feel a part of it, and it's, you feel it, you get enveloped by the world this movie creates.
I felt that way even though I did not see it in 3D.
Cool.
I felt like I was, in a jungle with
Yeah.
them. It looked real. And by it looked real, what I mean to say is the trees, the plants, the rocks, the ground, the sky, the water, it all looked real.
Right.
The animals looked almost real.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't have Uncanny Valley with the animals.
They looked almost real.
Because again, I think for me, it comes down to the eyes. And
The eyes were fine.
I thought the eyes were fine. And I was actually sort of moved by some of those performances. When Lupita Nyong'o and her she-wolf character and Mowgli have to sort of part ways.
That was quite moving.
Yeah. And in that moment, I was the thing in front of me was happening. It was
Right.
only later I go, oh yeah, that was just like that was a cartoon. This movie is a cartoon with a kid in it,
It's a digitally animated film that looks like live action
Yeah.
with a live action human being at the center of it.
Like the entire movie is Gene Kelly dancing with Jerry Mouse.
Pretty much.
But it pretty much works. The one thing in this movie that I found kind of that I wish they had sort of committed one way or the other was the music, or more specifically the show tunes
Yes.
from the 1967 version.
The rollicking, bouncy, swinging songs from
Yeah.
1967.
And it's kind of like, look, either you have them in this movie and it's a musical, or you don't. And so to then have this movie that's pretty straightforward and fairly serious and photorealistic in its own way, and then suddenly have Baloo and Mowgli do a verse out of The Bare Necessities, or suddenly have Christopher Walken do a chunk of I Want to Be Like You, it's kind of like, wait, what movie are we watching now? Because then and then those songs end and we're back to the other movie that it was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it makes sense that in the
A
closing,
fairly serious-minded film.
yeah, in the closing credits, sure, you let Christopher Walken go nuts and do all of I Want to Be Like You. You have Scarlett Johansson sing Trust in Me. but incorporated in this film that is otherwise not really the kind of movie that accommodates show tunes. It just feels like this weird compromise of, well, we have to do this or you're going to be annoyed, but we don't really, we're not going to mold the rest of the film to fit this material. But beyond that, I think it works pretty well.
I never, like I was saying earlier, I never believed that I was looking at actual animals. Mm-hmm. Not just because they were speaking, because they used, as I said on KCRW the other day, there were probably more real animals in Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Exactly.
They used real dogs in that movie. And then they made them talk.
Right.
This movie makes fake animals talk. And they look, you know, just this much like fake animals. So,
maybe I'm less picky on this. I didn't get that.
I don't feel like I'm picky. I feel like I just immediately, each one of them, I just thought, okay, well, you're not. This is a digital rendering of an animal. It's not. And I know it is.
Well,
I am seeing the disconnect between an actual animal and a.
On one level, I knew that that's what I was watching, but there was nothing, there was no tell for me that was, that's like, okay, yeah, you know, it
I bought certain them. Movements of each animal where it looked a little, maybe even too fluid. And so, almost an overcorrect, maybe. Uh-huh. So, but that's not, that wasn't really a problem for me.
I see.
None of this was a problem for me. I feel like maybe people listening to us talk about this might consider us to be a little low energy on the subject.
Yeah, no. I mean,
but the fact is that I am a little low energy on this subject because it is a... I don't want to take anything away from the fact that it is a technical achievement.
Mm-hmm.
It is a really, it's a marvelous technical achievement. It's pretty stunning to look at. But because nothing was added or subtracted to this story other than the ending, which is going to allow for sequels, I didn't feel invested or a sense of surprise or...
I'd say
there was no discovery for me.
Little kids
watching this film.
Little kids who come to this as
well,
their
little kids shouldn't even be in this.
Well,
movie.
Yeah, it's a little dark.
You scare them to death.
Yeah, but I would say children who maybe come to this not knowing the previous version.
Correct.
Like if this is your introduction to this, then yeah, this will be their, that'll be a good takeaway for them, and then they'll still enjoy the 67 version as its sort of goofball cousin
but
of the same material. But yeah, I
you want to be a good 6 or 7 years old before you're watching this film.
But here's the thing with these Disney remakes. There's
take no 3 or 4 year old to this.
No, definitely not.
Be very
they're caught in a bind in terms of, I mean, for us, not for the public at large, obviously, since a lot of them make a lot of money. But you either wind up with something like Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella, which is beautifully mounted, but brings no new ideas to the table. Maybe a little bit of sympathy or perspective of the stepmother, but that's about it.
Cinderella was beautiful enough for me to really get into its sort of solid, old-fashioned qualities. Mm. And I enjoyed Cinderella more than this.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is... the choices in these movies, either you're doing that or you do something like Alice in Wonderland, where you completely throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
Which is not in and of itself a bad suggestion, but you better replace it with something else and that movie doesn't. I mean, that has no point of view or anything interesting to say.
Right.
So it's like, you know, we kind of want these remakes to be familiar enough, but then also... unfamiliar enough so that there's a reason to do it again, you know. You know, I think Maleficent maybe gets closer to that. That's a movie that I think it's hampered with other problems in terms of the visuals, but at least story-wise, they're shifting the perspective and they're telling that story in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, as I've been saying, I am looking forward to what Bill Condon does with Beauty and the Beast, because you know that show's already been a Broadway musical in and of itself.
Right, right.
So, and it was, I mean, it was a musical already. And
that's,
then,
that's a dude that knows why a musical needs to exist.
Absolutely. And I think really, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that he really brought to the Twilight table was, I think that he intuits a lot about the female, particularly female adolescent perspective. I mean, Catherine Hardwicke obviously nailed that, but then I think some of the in-between people were not so strong in that department.
And what he, what he's good at with musicals is just, he has a great understanding of spectacle.
Sure.
And that's necessary for Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Just as it was necessary with Dreamgirls.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing what he's got to do with that one. But, yeah, in general, so much of these movies just feel like, we were just talking about this on Facebook, like, yes, as a studio strategy, this has paid off really well for Disney. Especially when you look at their attempts to do something more original, like Million Dollar Arm or McFarland USA, which
Million
is,
Dollar Duck.
Yes, which have not done, which have kind of tanked. It's like, on, from an accounting level, yes, I get it. This is a great strategy that you guys are retooling all your old animated films as live action movies, and you're making, you know, handfuls of money, bully for you. But from a creative side, you know, yeah, I think I would be more excited about this movie if it wasn't a thing where I could just sort of, I was sort of ticking off the plot beats that I knew were coming because I'd seen the other movie, you know.
Indeed.
But it's still good, and I think you should, I still think people should see it, but don't expect any kind of radical revision of this. Not even, I mean, I haven't read the Kipling stories, but I mean, don't expect a radical revision of Disney's previous exploration of the Kipling stories.
Yeah, it's quite good as an object. But if you don't feel enthusiasm for it before you go in, then you don't have any reason to see it. Does that make sense?
No, that's totally fair. Yeah, it's... Yes, it is. If you were going to make this movie, they made this movie really well in terms of the technical aspects and casting and all that stuff. But if you didn't care about this and would only be interested in it if they had a different point of view or different mode of storytelling, you're not going to get that.
And like you said, the music really is a strange fit.
Yeah.
It interrupts the tone quite a bit. And they even recorded Scarlett Johansson singing Trust in Me.
Yeah, I mentioned that. It's in the closing credits.
But
they didn't put it in the movie proper.
Did I miss you saying that?
Yes.
Where was I?
Not listening.
Did I zone out for a second?
Uh-huh.
Maybe I did.
You've been known to do that.
It's the middle of the afternoon.
Yes, well, everything out of my mouth is
just
gold.
Woke up from my little nap, you know, and
you need to be
feeling
chill.
You
need to be making sure not to lose a single nugget of the precious gems that spill forth.
Barbershop, the next cut. I was going to say the final cut. The next cut. It's the third Barbershop movie.
Right. Fourth if you include Beauty Shop.
But you don't include Beauty Shop. Because Beauty Shop is terrible,
but
and
it
because
still counts.
It's set in a different town. And
no, but the people in Beauty Shop are in this movie. Or at least some of them are. Isn't Beauty Shop the movie where they figure out they have to merge shops or whatever?
God, I can't remember.
Because Ice Cube has at least a cameo in Beauty Shop, so it's not like they're different universes.
I saw Beauty Shop. Here's all I remember.
Does Regina Hall run the Beauty Shop?
I don't remember. I remember it just was bad, and I wanted to leave as quickly as I could. Terrible film. Queen Latifah, Rudy Huxtable. I remember them in it, unless I'm thinking of some other movie.
You're right. It is Queen Latifah. Oh, you're right, and it's set in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm baffled, because I thought
you should be baffled.
I thought these were canonical.
Maybe you weren't the one. Maybe you're the one not paying attention. No, Beauty Shop was just sort of like a spin-off brand.
I thought there was at least like a walk-on from somebody to like tie them together somehow.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Ice Cube. I've come to Atlanta to give my blessing to the Beauty Shop.
Oh, I don't know what to believe anymore. All right, anyway, this is the third Barbershop movie.
The Barbershop movies, for me, are like turning on four episodes in a row of a sitcom I never watch, but that doesn't offend me.
Right. Like, it's a TBS sitcom not produced by Tyler Perry.
I'm not even talking like that. I'm talking about, like, I don't hate The Big Bang Theory. I won't run screaming from it.
Mm-hmm. You just won't tune in
for it. I just don't tune in for it. But when I have been in a position to stare at it,
mm-hmm.
like if I'm waiting in a doctor's office or something, I sit there and I go like this from time to time. You know, like, there's four laughs in an episode of Big Bang Theory.
Sure. I've never watched it, but I'll take your word for it.
And so, in a barbershop movie, there are half a dozen laughs per half hour, like a sitcom.
These movies are very much workplace sitcoms.
They're good laughs.
Yeah, I think, you know, but it does feel like TV. And this one has a sort of dollop of...
Can you say TV the way you normally say TV?
TV! it does have kind of a dollop of, you know, sort of community activism thrown in for good measure this time.
More than a dollop. That's the point of the movie.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, it's
set in the south side of Chicago, like the other two barbershops.
Right, but it's still a sitcom.
And they've got... the south side of Chicago has a problem, a real life problem,
yes.
At this point in history. Gang violence is... to call it out of control would suggest that there's a reasonable amount of gang violence. Right.
Well, I believe in Chirac, they cite the example that more people are killed there, more adult men are killed in the south side of Chicago every year than troops fighting in Iraq.
Yeah.
I don't have those numbers in front of me, but that's what they said.
And that's insane.
Yes.
And so the barbershop world sits inside this, and Ice Cube has decided that he has to move the shop. Particularly when a former barber who becomes a city council guy,
right,
is
played by Save the Last Dance.
Part of a, yeah, what's his name?
He's one of those three name guys.
Sean something.
Yeah.
I don't want to say Sean William Scott.
Yeah, that's not Sean Patrick Flannery either, but it's...
But so, they want to build an enclosure. This is the wildest part. They want to build an enclosure around the entire area.
Well, they want to basically...
So that there's only one way in and one way out traffic-wise.
Right.
Which would serve as a couple of bizarre consequences.
Sean Patrick Thomas.
Caging people in.
Right.
And
keeping people out.
And keeping people out, which would destroy businesses.
Yeah.
So Ice Cube is thinking, well, we got to get out of here. We have to move the shop
and,
to the north
and
side.
And his son, who attends school.
Furthermore, yes, his young son.
It seems to be possibly falling into gangs himself.
Is being courted.
Right.
By Tyga.
Oh, is that who that was?
Who's no stranger to courting young people.
Oh, hot take. So yeah, Ice Cube wants to move the shop to the north side of Chicago without bothering to consult with his partner, Regina Hall, who owns the beauty shop half.
May I interject something?
He's just going to make that decision.
I really wish Regina Hall had been given more to do.
Oh my God, no kidding.
Because she's one of my favorite people in movies, just period.
So funny in the About Last Night
and
remake.
She's so funny, and when she's not allowed to be funny, and then not given anything else to replace that with,
yeah,
when she's just a presence in the film.
She's like a plot placeholder, basically.
I want more for her.
Yes.
I get that the film really wanted to shine a spotlight on Nicki Minaj.
Yes.
And give her a lot of the funny material to deal with. And it did.
And she's fine with it.
And she's got a comedy career in films if she wants one.
Mm-hmm.
But the...
And her assets are highlighted.
Well, that's part of her character. And it's always been sort of part of the Nicki Minaj cartoon persona.
Right. Yeah. And the boy, like, as I said in my review on the Wrath, the movie shoots her like the monolith in 2001.
Yeah. It's when you are Nicki Minaj's butt, you are
ready for your close-up.
You are part of her character. And that is, and she knows that.
Yes.
And that's, and part of me,
oh yeah, no, it never feels like she's not party to this.
Yeah. She has cornered the market on booty comedy, and
in the way that Jane Mansfield could appreciate her own presence as a visual gag.
Yeah.
And that I think Sofia Vergara does as well.
Yeah.
So does Nicki Minaj.
Other thing, I feel like as a white audience member, I feel like I learn stuff from watching these films. Because they are conversations, like you said earlier, I guess on What the Flick.
Well, no, yeah, when I came out of the movie, our friend Alinda, who's been on the show before,
yeah,
I said, I feel like I get to hear conversations that are going on when, like, white people aren't around.
Yeah.
And Alinda just said, get on Black Twitter.
No, she's right about that. I am a big fan of Black Twitter.
Yes.
I follow lots of folks on Black Twitter. And again, those conversations are happening on Black Twitter. But that's still a removal.
Sure.
That's still me eavesdropping.
Right.
You know, it's not a conversation I'm joining in on.
Sure.
Because I don't have the place to speak.
Yeah.
My job is just to listen.
You're being invited to be privy to these conversations.
Yeah. And so unless someone blocks me.
Yeah.
For being a jerk, I get to keep eavesdropping. And so Alinda is correct about that. But at the same time, you know, there is a certain freedom that happens. It's like when we're having dinner here.
Sure.
And it's all gay dudes.
Yeah.
You know straight people want to end on that conversation. You know they want to hear.
Yeah.
What's going on in that conversation. But you know, and I know.
That we're not going to have that conversation.
That we're not going to have those conversations when they're around.
Sure.
Because nothing is off limits.
Right.
In that conversation.
Yeah.
It's
one of those things that generally speaking, I like about movies. I like movies about people who do jobs that I don't quite understand how that works and sort of break down the minutiae of how that works. I love movies that place me into other cultures that I am not witnessing unfolding on a day-by-day basis. And some of those cultures can be foreign ones, and some of them can be within the United States.
Yeah.
So there's just something about getting to be in that space and privy to those conversations and witnessing the opinions that the black characters express about black issues in a way that doesn't have to be filtered for white audiences.
Right.
You know, that's fascinating.
Yeah, there's no attempt to sell this or to ingratiate itself to a white audience.
Yeah.
And I'm happy about that. Here's the thing I'm not happy about. I would like for the subplots of this film not to have to be subplots. For example, the storyline with Eve and Common, and Nicki Minaj, that's its own movie.
Mm.
Yes, it is, and here's why. I have not seen a black romantic film since Beyond the Lights. That was 2014. There should be a black film by black creatives for black audiences that white people can pay to go see if they want to.
Right.
Every week. That should be every week and not every few months.
Okay,
one of its kind several years.
I'm in total agreement. The only reason that I quibble about that particular subplot being its own movie is that there's not much to it.
Well, you could write something for
it. You could turn it into something better.
It's a romantic triangle, essentially.
Yes.
It's about trust and about marriage and about, you know, bodies and...
On its face, there's not much there, but you certainly could develop into something. No, I agree. I totally agree that there should be a lot more black movies about a lot more subjects and in a lot more genres. I don't know that that's this movie's fault that those movies don't exist.
I'm just saying that
I think that those subplots in this movie again sort of add to the TV-ness of it. They all feel like the B stories.
Yes.
You know, if this were a half hour show, like there might be let's say this is really a 4-episode arc about the gang stuff and about how the barbershop is going to respond to the gang stuff.
Right.
Whether it's they're going to move or they're going to stay there and have this truce and give out free haircuts and try and make a difference and you know blah 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 all that stuff. So that's the A story. So then the B stories for those episodes would be the Common Eve, Nicki Minaj love triangle, the nerdy haircutter guy who has the sort of flirtation thing going on with
and him. And who everyone thinks might be gay,
which guy got really tired of. And the woman in the beauty shop.
That didn't bother me so much.
There's, given that this movie is about like black empowerment and about... you know, not letting the government fix things for you and like being proactive as a community and all that stuff. Then when a movie like that then turns around and has this sort of like sort of blithe homophobia where it's not like actively homophobic, but there's just this sort of like factor.
I didn't see it that way. I saw it as just sort of generic male bonding, sort of ball busting.
There's also kind of a block.
And there's even a line toward the end of the film where... the woman that he's involved, that he wants to get with, she says, "I wouldn't care if you were gay. I like you. You're my friend."
Right, but that's late in coming, though. That's after all the other stuff.
Either way, the film says it out loud.
Fine. There's also, I think, kind of a blithe sexism going on with the like I said, the idea that Regina Hall is supposedly the co-owner of this business, and he's making all these decisions behind her back without telling her. And then when she finds out, she forgives him in like 30 seconds. So I think that there's a certain kind of like straight guy thing all over this movie.
Well, there's a straight guy thing over a lot of movies.
Well, yeah, there is. But I feel like I need to call it out when I see it.
No, you should. You should.
Anyway, but so the B stories to me, I mean, the subplots to me just sort of felt like the B stories of a TV show. There's also a character who's introduced in the first 5 minutes that I immediately knew what was going to befall that person. It was like such klutzy telegraphing that it's just like they might as well just have a big red neon sign over his head, you know. But I was entertained. I had a good time. I'm glad I saw it. And if you've liked the other ones, yeah, this one's fun.
It's good enough.
Yeah,
it's fine.
It's fine. In limited release is the latest from John Carney called Sing Street. John Carney is the guy that did Once and Begin Again, two films I was a big fan of. And,
Set in Ireland.
Set in Ireland.
About a young boy who is his parents. You feel, or rather the film gives you visual clues from time to time that they... once were securely middle class,
right?
Possibly even securely aspirational middle class, like almost upper middle class, in that they still have an old Mercedes wagon that they drive around,
right?
And they were once a reasonably happy family in a house where all the kids have their own rooms, and they're not poor,
right?
But now they are because the economy in Ireland in the mid 80s. Tanked,
yeah.
Just like the economy in England in the mid '80s went down the toilet, and because of Margaret Thatcher, and they have to take him out of his school and send him to
Catholic school.
I assume it's a free
parochial
school that is rough.
Yeah.
Did you stay through the closing credits?
Yes, where it said that like many schools in Ireland, you know, the Sing Street School has since become
something really wonderful.
Yes, an example of tolerance and inclusion of all.
30 years ago.
Yeah, so this is a real place that the school is set at, SYNGE, Sing Street School.
Yeah, and apparently in the 80s it was a snake pit.
Yes.
And now, according to the closing credits, it is a wonderful non-parochial school, multicultural and progressive, full of lovely teachers and students who are having a great time.
Or at least that's what they had to say in the closing credits to get access to the school in the first place.
Right. Well, do you think they shot it at the school because the place looked like hell?
I don't know.
No.
But set dress a place to look like hell. That's easy enough.
Well, you could set dress it, I guess. Yeah. But anyway.
He becomes smitten with this girl who hangs out at the stoop across the street from the
school.
She's
a couple years older than he is. Yes. She's like 17. He's 15.
She claims she's a model. So to get her to talk to him, he asks her to be in the video for his band. And when she says yes, he realizes he has to have a band. So he starts putting one together. And his older brother, who's played by, what's that?
He already wanted to have a band.
Yes.
He was already a young musician, playing his guitar in his room, making up his own songs in his room. This doesn't come from nowhere.
Right, yes.
He has this dream already. Yeah.
His older brother, who's played by the not statutory rapist from Transformers Age of Extinction, the one who's got the laminated Robin Hood Law card in his pocket. James Raymer, is that his name?
I think so.
Anyway,
he looks like if Hemsworth and Chris Pratt had a baby together.
I was going to say Chris Pratt and Seth Rogen.
Perhaps.
Because in this movie, he's like long-haired, pot-smoking slacker guy.
Right.
Anyway, so he becomes sort of a musical Sherpa for his younger brother and exposes him to all these different kinds of music. And the brother, the kid, the main kid in the movie, Connor, rallies together different outsider weirdos from his school, and they do indeed form a band. And to answer the question that was the original title of Begin Again, which is, can a song save your life? Yes, it can, in a John Carney movie.
Yeah.
I don't know how he does this. He makes these movies that are charmingly non-cynical, and they are about, you know, what Mr. B. Natural would call the power of music.
Yeah. Richard Curtis stomps his feet and pouts every time he sees one of these movies. You know he does.
It's true. Richard Curtis should be so lucky lately. I dig what this guy does, and I dig it again here. You know, I think it's really, his movies are charming and funny, and, you know, this time he's working with unknown actors. Obviously, Begin Again was a cast of familiar faces, but, you know, he has that magic, the way that, you know, when I reviewed Begin Again, I talked about how that Depression-era audiences knew that Depression-era musicals were total fantasias.
Yes.
But they bought into them anyway, and they became emotionally committed to them, even though they knew deep down that they weren't true. And so in these movies, you know, people will play music on rooftops or in alleyways or whatever. And, I mean, nothing is realistic about it. But you go with it anyway because it's ultimately about these characters that you come to care for and, you know, them sort of discovering this music they have inside themselves and getting it out into the world.
Yeah, it's very sweet. It's very mainstream in the way that We Are the Best is not.
Sure. Yeah.
Because what these kids are about is finding the kind of punk rock truth that lives inside very good, polished pop music.
Right.
And that may sound like two things that don't really meet.
They don't want to be Joy Division. They want to be Duran Duran.
Right. And so there's a whole...
But an honest Duran Duran.
There's a whole bunch of pop music from England in the 80s that was informed by punk rock, but only used it as a launching pad.
Sure.
for becoming something entirely else, for becoming something, you know, sophisticated. Like, the Style Council, of all things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That band had its roots in
the Jam,
in punk rock, yeah, and evolved into something else. And unlike in the United States, where bands firmly stayed outside of the mainstream if they came from punk rock, only rarely sort of dipping their toes into that at the behest of a major label
like the Ramones.
You know, we could sell you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those bands were plentiful in the UK. And there was even, you know, if you were an American reader of the NME back then,
right,
like I was, music criticism was quite often tailored toward that, to where, you know, albums by bands like ABC were written about in a serious way, in a way that they were not taken seriously in the United States when they came over here. Because that stuff came over to the United States, and if it became popular over here, the general view of it was, well, that's fluffy stuff from England.
Yeah, like that's music for girls.
Music for girls, you know? Yeah.
And it's fashion statement music, whereas this movie you have, like, the brother talking about, like, why John Taylor as a bassist is important.
Yeah, so that's an interesting element of the film. There's a touch of commentary on racism in the film that is really specific to England, or rather the UK, because we're talking about Ireland, that I actually didn't really understand all that well. And I had to go sort of look it up. Some derogatory racial slurs I guess any slur is derogatory.
I suppose those praiseworthy.
But that are so distinct to that, you know, geographic area, that I had to go Google them when I got
There's also this thing of, I just flew out of my head. Oh, well, I like the where they sort of touch on the idea that part of the reason the parents are so unhappy is that they were, you know, strict Catholic teenagers who got married because they wanted to have sex.
Yes.
You know, and that they found that now, like, 15, 20 years later, they don't like each other. You know?
What I love about his three films so far is that they understand the pull of personal freedom.
Sure.
And they construct paths for their characters to get there, even if it's a foolish path, and even if it's a path that might be harmful to them,
right,
or even ruin them, or not work at all.
Sure. The movie's not saying, like, oh yes, enter the music industry, that's going to be the greatest thing ever.
I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but it ends with a sequence that filled me with immense anxiety.
I could see that.
And made me think, oh no, why are you doing it like this? This is not the way. You don't even have a... And I can't even tell you.
Yeah, no, I know what you're thinking.
But, like...
I did not think of it that way, but of course you did. I can see that. Here's what I think his movies do, though, is that his movies give you characters who... Music gives them a way to express themselves that nothing else does.
Yeah.
That speaking... or having sex even, or whatever else,
right,
does not give them that license to explain themselves, to express their feelings, any of that stuff, the way that writing a song does, or performing a song does. So yeah, love it, love it, love it. Go see it.
It's adorable. It really is adorable.
Yeah. And the original songs are quite good.
Yeah, they're not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I sat through it. We saw it separately, and I sat through it thinking, oh, I know whose iTunes these songs are going into. I'll be hearing these songs again.
I haven't done it yet, but yeah.
In a car.
They're going to be there.
In my near future.
Yeah, yeah. Drive It Like You Stole It is definitely coming up on shuffle. Just get ready.
There's one sequence that takes place in a school gymnasium.
Oh, the music video shoot. It's so great.
That they're shooting a music video, and it's you know,
it's a low rent affair.
Zero budget and not anywhere near what the kid wants it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But as they're practicing the song, you see the video he dreams of
mm-hmm.
in his head.
Yeah.
It's glorious. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, was shot like on the last day. Like that was the last thing they shot.
Probably.
Mostly because everybody had haircuts. But like the movie could have ended with that scene and you would have walked out feeling
on a cloud.
Like, yeah. But it's lovely.
Yeah.
Now, I am full of shame because 2 days ago, I bent down to reach for a thing. Now, Grandpa's got that sciatica. Sometimes flares up. That's what happened. And for the past 48 hours, I have been feeling ouchy in my lower back. Had this big plan. I was going to drive out yesterday to the Royal. You were going to go with me.
Oh, right, yeah.
To see the new Alexander Sokurov film.
Right.
Francophonia. Boy, howdy, do I love that Alexander Sokurov. Filmmaker of Moloch and The Sun and Russian Ark and Mother and Son and Father and Son. I'm blanking on others. Faust. This is his new film, Francophonia. I couldn't get in a car yesterday. I couldn't sit through a film yesterday. I have not seen it yet.
But we will.
But I'm gonna. And it will be discussed on the next show. Because this is the second day and I'm already feeling a little better.
Okay.
I'm moving around a lot more.
We'll get you a truss.
But I have, you know, was all stoked for it to open. And then, oh, my back, I'm 100, you know. Also fat. Fat people should not reach for things. Fat people should have the little grabby...
Fat people should do their best to remain more limber.
That's that. Also
fat,
that.
Fat people should dig their dusty yoga DVDs out and listen, start doing them again.
Listen. I didn't ask you to put me on blast.
I'm just saying. If you're gonna,
don't just saying.
If you're going
no, to
start making prescriptions about what fat people should and shouldn't do.
This fat person. How's that? Let me personalize it.
Anyway.
Dust off your yoga DVDs.
Me. Well, don't be telling anybody to get a grabber. Just because you need a pry bar.
But the grabbers are... It would be fun to have a grabber.
With a little alligator head on.
Rascal or no rascal.
We did see the other limited, very limited release.
The new reissue. The new Godard reissue.
Yeah, A Married Woman.
It's not new. It's from 1964.
But the reissue is new.
Yes.
Une Femme Mariée.
Yeah.
I had not seen this one. And
this was one I hadn't seen either.
And there were a couple of things in this movie that I was like, wow, Pedro Almodovar saw this movie and took some notes.
Well, here's the thing about Godard. Everyone saw all of Godard's films and took notes.
No, absolutely. But it's just interesting to go back to the ones that you haven't seen from that era and find the references that, you know, to the people who got there first, you know, who saw before you. There's a lot of images of 60s lingerie ads of like women's sort of bras and foundation garments that reminded me a lot of the opening credits of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And then there's a scene later on where like the lead character is standing in front of this gigantic sort of wheat paste billboard of some woman in a bra looming over her head. And it's a lot like that shot in All About My Mother, where they're standing outside of the theater, you know, where A Streetcar Named Desire is playing with the giant face of Uma Rojo.
Yeah.
So it was just like, oh yeah. You know, so it's like when you, if you listen to a band that, you know, references older music and then you hear the older songs, you go, oh, that's what that was, you know. But anyway, fascinating film.
It stars Macha Merrill
mm-hmm.
as a young married woman.
Yes.
Who's having an affair.
She is married to a guy who has a son from a previous marriage, who's a pilot. The guy, not the son. And she's having an affair with an actor. And both men are trying to command her monogamy, basically. And she's not quite committed to either of them. And in the opening credits, in a very Godardian way, we're told this is fragments of a film. So there's a lot of, like, a lot of it
which
is...
Which, you know, going in, yes, that's what it's going to be.
Of course.
Because Godard is famous for that sort of discontinuous...
Elliptical editing.
...style of storytelling.
So there's these sort of snippets of conversations and things, and you don't get the beginning or the end. You know, you sort of join them already in progress, and you're out of them before they're done. And then, you know, it's like that thing we talked about with Take Me to the River, this notion of like where you edit to the bare minimum of what you need to include to get the basic information across.
Right.
So, you know, so there's no fat in this movie. It's all just like, you know, there are some long Godardian conversations about the nature of love and, you know, the nature of acting and sort of, you know, the idea of commitment or whatever, but you know, there's the idea of love
and the idea of what love should look like.
Yeah.
It's highly constructed. Don't be mistaken.
Yeah.
Into thinking we're saying it's not constructed.
Yeah.
It's highly constructed and it is full of repetitions. It's full of, divisions.
There's a lot of close-ups of words where he finds words within other words, like there'll be a sign that says danger, and then he'll close up to where it just says ANGE, which is the French word for angel. Or he'll like there'll be a sign in an airport that says passage, but then he'll break it down to passage, which is, you know, unwise.
Yeah.
Little things like that where it's not exactly a Burroughs cut-up technique, because he's not juxtaposing different things with different things, but he's stripping words down to their essence and to their building blocks.
Right.
Which is what he's doing with her relationships as well. He's sort of stripping away everything down to the moments that they spend together and how they spend them together and what they, you know, what they get out of them.
Furthermore, he's mirroring activities and people.
Yeah. There are scenes where you see one woman's hand and one man's hand on screen, and it's only from the ring can you tell if it's the boyfriend's hand or the husband's hand.
And then that same shot will reverse itself later on in the film.
Right.
There is there's my phone going.
Yes.
It will ever be so.
Mm-hmm.
Here, let me shut that down. Where was I?
Repetition.
Yeah, there's so much repetition and so many splits between you know, what love is and what the idea of what the characters think love should be. And there's this constant tension in the story. The story is very simple. She meets with her lover, she meets with her husband. She has
They both wanted. They each wanted to get rid of the other one.
Yeah, conversations.
She lies to both of them.
She lies to both of them. She has conversations with different people. She has conversations with her professor, friend of the husband, with maid,
mm-hmm.
with her gynecologist, and with two young girls. Trying to explain sex to each other for the first time.
Well, she's not really... She's just sort of eavesdropping on that one.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second... That's... Yeah. The last one, she's just listening in. But in each of these interactions, before the final moment with the lover,
mm-hmm.
in each of these interactions, what is happening is the tension of of where you place yourself in the world of love versus, say, the image of love.
Mm-hmm.
Because she continually looks through these magazines.
Right.
She tells the maid, don't touch my magazines.
Mm-hmm.
As she is told not to touch someone else's record albums.
Right.
And so by consuming media, she is consuming ideas about love and what it should look like. And at the same time, being forbidden to consume them and telling other people to do the same thing.
Yeah, like she reads this long article in one of these women's magazines about the ideal bust, and it's all about there should be basically this equilateral triangle, like from the bottom of your neck to each of your nipples, essentially.
Yeah.
And she asks, what does equilateral mean? And then later the maid asks her, what does equilateral mean? Put down my magazines! but yeah, there's all these sort of, you know, and all the sort of lingerie ads, it's this sort of like this insane, unattainable ideal, and it's about literally squeezing yourself into an image that you can never really fulfill. I really dug it.
There is there's a sense of redundancy, of information being repeated to pointless effect. All from the beginning to the end, like he starts with words that tell you this is a film in black and white.
Right.
Well, you know that because you're looking at it.
Yeah.
The last sequence in the film is she's abandoning the lover. That's not a spoiler. She's abandoning the lover and tells him it's finished. It's finished.
Yeah.
That's the last thing in the film, and then the film says finished.
Fan.
and so I love the way Godard, throughout his entire career, has very sort of skillfully played with language and ideas and what those ideas mean in our heads versus what they mean to other people.
Sure.
And how ultimately you can never connect to another human being. Sorry.
What I also like about his movies, and which is to some extent a conscious choice of his, I just love the public spaces.
Yes.
In period movies.
Well, yeah.
Like I love in general, like an old movie where they walk into a supermarket. I'm just I'm so excited by that. Mm-hmm. And so in his movies, when they're in like a hotel lobby or a department store or a cafe or whatever. There's something that's so immediate about it, and so you can like there was no set dressing, and there's you know, this, no. It's not a set at all.
People
you know?
People in the shop are looking right into the camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I love that sort of weirdly documentary aspect of this otherwise very stylized kind of storytelling because it's just neat to get a glimpse of well, this is what department store looked like in France in 1964. You know,
it looked incredible, by the way.
Oh yeah. You were saying when they're lobby, you said this is like the apex of design.
I know. Is there such a thing as being decades-ist? Because I am. I am. Nothing looked as good as the mid-50s to the mid-60s.
Like sort of post-war modernism, would you call that?
Yeah. Nothing looked as good as that. From that moment on, the minute like, sorry Beatles, the minute you showed up... Everything started going to hell, design-wise.
The minute they grew their hair, I think.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, the early Beatles were fine. Once they got mixed up with the Maharishi, you know, design fell apart.
The world of mid-century design, nothing has ever looked cooler.
True.
Nothing since has ever looked cooler.
But you know what a strong aspect of that is?
Mm.
Women having to wear those god-awful pointy bras and those, you know, those... girdles
and men having to wear those boxy suits.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry, human beings.
You're messing with my line, my clean lines.
Do whatever it takes. Fit yourself into that. Or get out of my field of vision.
What's your DVD pick this week?
John Ford's The Informer.
Oh, yes.
Which is available. 1935. I had never seen it before. What an incredible movie.
Mm.
It's about a man who is part of the Irish resistance
right.
in 1922. But he's strapped and desperate and starving. And also not very smart.
No.
Played by Victor McLaughlin.
McLaughlin.
Scottish, actually.
Of Clan McLaughlin.
He's actually Scottish. He won an Academy Award for Best Actor.
Yep.
This film actually won 4 Oscars.
Hmm.
It was nominated for Best Picture. It did not win. Mutiny on the Bounty won. And it is... It was actually a pretty low-budget film. They didn't know that they were making something important. And to mask the cheap sets, they enveloped everything in fog.
Clever.
Which lent a...
Claustrophobia.
A hazy feeling to it, a dreamlike feeling, a claustrophobic feeling, and more importantly, a sort of metaphorical confusion to the subject, because the subject is, what do you do to survive versus what do you do to stay loyal to the people that you're committed to? Answer, get that money. And then live with haunting guilt and suspicion and fear until everyone comes and ruins you. Ta-da, the end. This and The Lost Patrol, in my ongoing chronological exploration of John Ford films, I took on this project because I didn't know enough about John Ford.
Mm.
Because he was... he's the American filmmaker.
Right.
And I was kind of under-knowledgeable about him. I've spent, by affinity... I've spent my adult life, as some of you listeners may know, diving deeply into the pool of European art house and Asian art house, but not so much into mainstream American, classic American film.
Hmm.
That's been my big blind spot.
Because you never took film classes, did you?
No, I've never taken... Well, I did. I took a one semester film class my freshman year of college, and
because I had
could not tell you a single movie we watched.
I
don't think it was a very good film.
I took a summer film class once. It was between my junior and senior year of high school, a university level film class, and the final paper we had to write was a breakdown of the final sequence of Ford's How Green Was My Valley.
Right,
and then I found the paper that I wrote in that class about 2 years later, and I couldn't understand a word of it.
What do you mean?
Like, I had written this paper, and I was during the class so immersed in this sort of like academic theoretical language.
Speak.
Yeah. It had all fallen out of my head, and I read the paper, and I was like, I don't even know what I'm saying. I wrote this? But anyway, I never need to see How Green Was My Valley again, because I watched that final sequence like 80 times.
I see.
This is before, you know. It wasn't even like a VHS. I think it was like there was a 3/4-inch tape that it ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and like rewind and watch it again and again and again.
Anyway, a great emotional experience, this film, which my understanding is that in later years, Ford pulled away from that sort of, you know, big emotional style.
I'll be curious to
that's
to
my understanding, just from overviews that I've read of his career in this process. But this is such a great movie, and you can really see when you watch his films chronologically, you watch him becoming himself. You watch, as a filmmaker, you watch him becoming a different kind of filmmaker. As he pushes harder and harder, apparently in mid-production, after I watched the movie, I read some of the production notes about it. The studio was going to abandon the film. They were going to dump it. He had one guy at the studio that was championing him and letting him do what he wanted. And when that guy left, the other suits in the place were like, why are you filming this in such a strange way? Why are you moving your camera this way? Why are you pointing it here? Why are you sweeping it through the crowd like that? Stop that. That's not what we do. And Ford was really upset. He was despondent. But then it got released, and the critics loved it, and the audiences loved it, and then the Academy Awards came. And, you know, the executives were shown.
I believe Maureen O'Hara wrote in her memoir about walking into Ford's office and he was having sex with a dude.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yes. Is that in her?
That's in her memoir, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean,
it was Hollywood.
creative people, and sexual freedom, that often goes sort of hand in hand.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he just wanted to see what it was like. Maybe he was bisexual.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I don't know.
But that's...
I'm not saying it like it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a
fun fact.
Fun fact. Fun fact about John Ford. Did you know?
Maureen O'Hara says.
My DVD pick this week is Begin Again, because...
The wind is sure blowing the curtain around, yeah, and making a clackety noise. How about...
You ever close the window?
Either close the window, pause the thing.
Having learned our lesson, there was no precarious items for the flapping window shade to knock over. anyway, that's taken care of. My DVD pick is Begin Again, because I feel like that didn't get the love that once got. I think it was, people thought, oh, well, it was obviously going to be a sophomore slump. And, you know, if a foreign director then makes a big American movie with a lot of recognizable names, you immediately think, oh, well, sell out. But I like it. I think it's very charming. And,
it's fine.
I think I like the songs in it a lot. A lot of them are written by, Greg Alexander, who was New Radicals. Keira Knightley, one of my favorite performances of hers. I like that the movie doesn't feel like they have to put Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo together, that they actually have this great sort of friendship mentoring relationship that does not turn into a romance, which wouldn't have worked with the characters as presented. A lot of great supporting turns by people like Mos Def and James Corden, and Adam Levine, of all people, is actually quite good in it.
Right.
And, you know, I like the songs, but I also love how they're written in such a way where, like, Keira Knightley can sing it acoustically, you know, with a guitar or whatever.
Right.
And then Adam Levine can turn the same song into, you know, an arena anthem.
Yes.
You know, and it's just, and it's like,
because his character's a jerk.
Exactly, yeah. And so it's just kind of it's an interesting thing to where you can see how a piece of music can be like transmogrified and from one thing to another. I think it's quite lovely. People should check it out if they have not seen it.
Here's a letter from Chris Robles.
Yeah.
Friend of the show.
Yes.
Subscriber, club member.
Donut friend of the show.
Donut friend of the show. He even begins his email, "Greetings, fellow donut fanciers." Isn't a financier a fancy French cookie or cake? I think it is.
It should be.
I think that's the name of
thought he was kidding. Is it really a thing?
I got to look that up. Hang on.
Why don't you read the letter and we can take that offline?
It is. It's a small French cake.
Yeah.
He says, possibly this will be the next Cronut. Alonso needs to see Possession.
Okay, yeah.
It was one of the first movies that Alexi, that's his man, demanded that I watch. And it's such a crazy movie experience. It's one of Alexi's favorite movies, and he loves to endlessly analyze what the heck the movie's about. We were probably one donut away from him stating his entire thesis about Possession the other day. It's a good thesis. It's a long thesis. Because I haven't been knifed in a long time, here is a list of our list, Alexi helped. Alexi says hi. Favorite horror movies of the moment. Possession.
Okay.
It Follows.
Yeah.
The Babadook.
Mm-hmm.
The Witch.
Mm-hmm.
The Legend of Hell House.
Yeah.
The Innocents.
Yep.
Goodnight Mommy.
Didn't see it, but I hear it's great.
It's really good. Mm-hmm. The Company of Wolves.
Oh, yeah.
Audition.
Yee.
Yeah. Rosemary's Baby.
Mm-hmm.
Honorable mention to Puffy Sleeves.
Is that a movie?
I guess. I haven't seen it.
That is 100% Knife of Horror.
Keep Up the Great Podcasting. Yes, that is 100% Knife of Horror. Subject line, is a movie sexist? Yes. That's the answer.
Generally speaking.
In general, the answer is yes. This is from Anthony. For what it's worth, someone, I forget who, once said that from a feminist perspective, there are three questions we can ask ourselves in order to determine whether or not a film is sexist. Is there more than one major female character in the movie? Is there more than one female character? If there is more than one female character, do they, in any scene, ever have a fairly substantial conversation with each other? If they do have a conversation, is that conversation between them about something other than a man? Yeah, that's the Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test.
Wait, okay, so yes, that's who that was.
Someone who coined that.
Alison Bechdel is the person who said that.
Whose work you should totally know. She did a great comic strip for years called Dykes to Watch Out For.
She did.
She wrote an extraordinary graphic.
Pretty wonderful, really.
Yes, she wrote an extraordinary graphic memoir called Fun Home, which was turned into a Tony-winning Broadway musical.
Yes. That being said, I don't know if I can say I agree or disagree. It's because I have not tried this test out on many films myself. Well, you know, neither have I, because it's not meant to be a be-all, end-all test.
Yeah, it's a...
Alison Bechdel says this herself.
Yeah, even she has said that she never intended it to be like this sort of litmus test that all movies had to pass. You know, I don't think I don't think The Great Escape is sexist for not having female characters in it, because it's set in a World War II prisoner of war camp, you know.
I'd be curious and interested in knowing whether or not you think Everybody Wants Some passes or fails the test. Well, didn't we discuss that when we talked about Everybody Wants Some?
Well, we talked about whether or not the film was sexist. I don't think we specifically addressed it in terms of the Bechdel test. There are not female characters that have conversations with each other about something that is not men.
I guess not.
But again, I don't think that not upholding those standards makes your movie sexist or not sexist.
P.S. I only tried this out on my most favorite movie, All About Eve, and was happy to see that it passed the test. I'd been worried about it because in that movie, Margot has some troubling lines about not feeling like she's a real woman because she's 40 and still unmarried. I thought perhaps these lines could classify the movie as sexist. It turns out, though, that because it passes the three-question test, we can instead classify this movie as having a character who's influenced by and or struggling with her own sexist beliefs, rather than a movie that, as a whole, is being sexist.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, sure.
You know, and again, that's the problem that you get into in trying to sort of have these overall sweeping, you know, tests. I wouldn't even say that Margot saying that she's, you know, damaged goods for being an unmarried woman over 40, it makes it sexist. I think it makes her a creature of her era, you know. That was the societal standard of the moment, and she was in defiance of that and felt that, you know, occasionally, you know, that was a problem. But the movie, I think, celebrates her for going her own way. And, you know, yes, she does eventually fall in love and get married. But I don't think the movie in any way is judging her for making the choices that got her to 40 as an unmarried woman. And so, by no means is that sexist. And also, you're applying the 2016 terms of sexist to 1950, you know, which you can't do. Or you shouldn't.
Correct. You should not! So last week, I asked everybody out there in the world
who had not written us before,
who had never written us before, to write us, tell us about yourself. We have some regulars who write us, who are always having a conversation with the show.
Yes,
and we like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're bored with them.
We don't want other people to not feel like they're welcome to interact with the program.
Check it out.
We got quite a few letters from y'all.
Somebody in Finland listens to us.
Ooh.
Yeah. This is from a person named Sara.
Mm-hmm.
S-A-A-R-A.
Okay.
Dear David and Alonzo.
Mm-hmm.
It's like my mom's here.
It's the last person that called you David.
Yeah. On the latest episode, you urged us to write in, so I thought I'd drop you a line and a list. I'm only a short-time listener, having discovered your podcast through What the Flick.
Yeah. You go read that letter. I'm gonna
read that letter, and you go fix that door.
Yeah.
The wind has picked up, and now things are clacking around and slamming. And that's what happens when you record in a big-time studio that is also your dining room. Discover the podcast through the What the Flick YouTube channel. Alonzo mentioning another podcast I already love, We Hate Movies, was one of the selling points. You have quickly become one of my must-listen weekly podcasts.
Ha-ha! Eat it, We Hate Movies!
I write to you from Helsinki.
Wow.
Where I've just returned from the screening of Luciano Onetti's Francesca, a delicious pastiche of early giallo films, which was shown at the Night Visions Film Festival. This biannual horror, sci-fi, fantasy cult fest also finally offered me a chance to see the excellent and upsetting The Witch, which sadly didn't get a wide theatrical release over here. This is the case with many smaller and indie films, but fortunately the film festivals step in at times like these. And as a not terribly important side note, the Night Visions guest of honor at this festival is Ruggero Deodato, who, as I am typing this, is probably giving a Q&A on his best-known film as we speak. Having no desire to see Cannibal Holocaust again, despite my respect for its place in cinematic history, I opted out of the screening, which sold out anyway. Nevertheless, I'm constantly impressed by the guests this festival invites over and happy that we have had this institution educate us for 2 decades now. Udo Kier, drunk on red wine and quoting his lines from Flesh for Frankenstein, was especially fun, and John Waters was an all-around delight.
He is indeed.
Anyway, I wanted to thank you for your edifying and entertaining podcast of the cinema.
Aww.
I've only been listening for a couple of months, but I've already learned more than I ever need to know about donut and hot dog acquisition in Los Angeles.
You can never really know enough.
I also experienced the serendipitous joy of preparing vegan burgers for a meal while you started talking about Dave's vegan burger meal the night before. As a proud junk food vegan, I take slight objection to Alonzo's protestation that processed vegan food is still processed. That is rather the point.
Okay.
Yeah, how you like that?
You're not getting me down.
Aside from the culinary anecdotes, I'm happy to have found a film podcast that is built on conversation, both interpersonal and intercinematic. Recently, your analysis of movies such as God's Not Dead 2 and The Witch have been particularly insightful to a non-American.
Huh.
After my short listenership, I dare not pick favorites yet, but let's just say the vegan burgers count. Lastly, here is a list of 10 films that have, no more or less, had a profound aesthetic effect on me and pushed me into further cinematic exploration. So, in a personal chronology, starting from the age of 4, peeking through my fingers at a black and white television set in mid-depression Finland. Number 1, Jans Funkmeyer's Alice.
Ooh.
1988.
Creepy.
Yeah. X-Men 2.
Yeah.
The Wicker Man.
I assume the original.
Innocence from 2004. Do I know that one? Do you know that one?
I do not.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Innocence, N-C-E? Or N-D-S?
Yeah.
Don't know that one.
Yeah. Maki Kaurismäki's The Worthless.
Okay.
No. I'm sorry. Not Aki. Mika Kaurismäki's.
Ah.
The Worthless. That's his brother.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm stupid. Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Velvet Goldmine.
Mm-hmm.
Hooray! Da, 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 da. I'm right.
I acknowledge that I need to see it again.
Cruising. Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Oh, come on. Cave of Forgotten Dreams is great.
I think it's okay.
You're okay.
It's no Pina.
You're no Pina.
If you're going to 3D documentary.
The Duke of Burgundy.
Which we still need to see.
Sorry, you are 100% knife.
Yeah, sure. if I felt like it, I could quibble with Inland Empire and Cave and Velvet Goldmine, but I'm feeling generous today, so yeah, you can have them.
One more. This is another new person.
Mm.
I'm responding to Dave. This is from Phil.
Uh-huh.
I'm responding to Dave's request for letters that tell you a little bit about ourselves. I'd like to share with you how Linoleum Knife came into my life. In 2005, I started reading Dave's reviews on movies.com. So you got in on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Because I started writing reviews for movies.com in 2005.
And we didn't start the show till 2010.
I didn't always know where his head was at.
Welcome to the club.
But it was nice to see another gay dude out there who liked punk rock and gore. Dave was not the type of homo I had a lot of exposure to, especially while living closeted in a Midwest suburb. This I found refreshing. I am refreshing. I'm like a breath of breeze. Cool, minty breeze.
You're a breath of breeze.
I'm a blast of Arctic pleasure in a hot, barren landscape.
Yeah, just keep reading. You're just making sounds now.
A couple of years later in college, I thought I brought Dave's reviews to my friend Andrew's attention, who was very responsive to his sense of humor. I vividly recall how much he enjoyed Dave's description of Aquamarine. I forgot that movie existed.
Little girls and a mermaid, right?
Yeah. He described Dave's description of Aquamarine as the cinematic equivalent of a high-pitched squeal. As time went on, my visits to the site grew less frequent until I eventually stopped going there altogether. Hey! Did you lose interest in my words?
Obviously.
Linoleum Knife found its way onto my radar last year when Andrew discovered it and repeatedly told me to listen to it. I'm so glad I took his advice. In addition to finding the show hilarious, interesting, and informative, it's been a great companion to my somewhat recent arrival in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
In late 2014, I moved here from Kansas City for a job and to see what life in the Golden State was like. Well, as Katy Perry says, nothing comes close to the Golden Coast.
It's true.
Yeah.
What?
Daisy Dukes. I'm wearing Daisy Dukes right now.
Yeah, yes.
Bikini on top.
I promise he's not.
I've grown to absolutely love it here, and hearing you two talk about anything LA related is a really great way to feel more connected to the area. Thank you for the laughs, the insight, and something to look forward to each week. I appreciate how good you are to your listeners and for continuing to make America great again. My love is your love. Signed, Listener Phil. Listen, Listener Phil, your letter's fine and all, but you got a lot of reviews to go catch up on. Stop reading.
Well, you bored him, clearly. You basic. But he's listening now. That's what matters. So if we didn't get to your letter this week,
we'll get to him. We got like 20 letters.
Yeah,
this week.
Which is great. Thank you. And keep them coming. If you've never written to us before, drop us a line. Let us know what you're about and how you found us and all that stuff. And
so,
we'll
hey,
be
before we go.
Of course. Yes.
I want to talk about subscribing to the Linoleum Knife Club.
Yes, our Patreon page.
And I want to give a little a better... I want to explain how it works. There seems to be some confusion. We have about 7 or 8 folks who are donating at the $4 level, but have somehow managed to stipulate on their donation that they don't want anything. And I think that means they don't want they don't even want LKTV, which is the whole point of subscribing at the $4 level. We also have some people who have just given $4 a one-time donation of $4, and I want to explain. When you subscribe to Linoleum Knife, the club, when you become a member of our club, when you join our club, Your subscription through Patreon is a monthly amount of money. Now, you are fully welcome to make a one-time donation. If that's what you choose to do, for whatever reason you've chosen to do that, you are also fully welcome to subscribe at a monthly rate and not want anything. I know of at least two people who have explicitly told me in a private email that all they want is LKTV, even though that is the podcast of the television.
Even though they subscribed at a level that would get them more stuff.
They subscribed at a level that where they would get more stuff, like the t-shirts and the mugs and the zines and all that kind of stuff. But they've said, look, I've got too many things already. I just want LKTV, but I'm still subscribing at a higher level than $4 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what happens. If you subscribe at a level of $4 per month, you get LKTV, the podcast of the television. Averages out to about $1 a week. Or 50 cents per host. If you subscribe at the $7 level, you get LKTV plus an item. One of the t-shirts we have, the tote bag, the mug. You subscribe at, $12? You start getting more things like Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife episodes.
Club meetings.
Access to our monthly club meetings where we all get together and watch a movie streaming at exactly the same time on the same night. And then we talk about it before. Sometimes we talk about it during. We talk about it after. All the way up to a $20 a month level, which gets you all the things, all the Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knives. You get the LK Selector stuff that is like four times a year. You get things sent to you, and then we all gather together to talk about that. You get LK zines. First one, the endless discussion of donuts is becoming a zine called Endless Donuts. So that's what it means. If you were confused and you thought that $4 one time gets you indefinite LKTVs, that is not the case. If you made a mistake and you pressed a button somewhere that said, I'll give you money and yet I don't want anything, and you're wondering why you're getting nothing, that might be why. So, you know, double check on yourself. Here's what I'm probably going to do. I'm going to email these people.
Instead of taking up 10 minutes on our podcast.
I just feel like it's important to explain it again. I don't want to be the people who are constantly selling the subscriptions every week,
yes.
But I also want to clarify what they are.
Well, if you go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, one word, it's pretty much all spelled out there. And yes. If you have questions about that, feel free to drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll happily walk you through the process if there's anything about it that doesn't make sense.
Next week's episode of Linoleum Knife is going to be one day late.
Right.
Instead of recording on Sundays and having it up and ready on Sundays.
We'll be doing it on Monday morning and
or afternoon.
It'll go up.
Your flight comes back Monday. In from Texas on Monday morning.
Right. I will be. You know. I'm in Dallas next weekend. If you are in Dallas, Fort Worth, check out the USA Film Festival next week. They've got a lot of really exciting things, and I will be doing a lot of Q&As. I know that opening night, I'm talking to Alfred Molina and Ira Sachs after a screening of Little Men, which I saw at Sundance and liked quite a bit.
Oh, is he in the new Ira Sachs movie too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Okay, and then closing night, Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship, and I will be doing a Q&A with Whit Stillman, which I'm very excited about.
So are there any other guests that are going
to
be there?
To my knowledge, just Stillman at this point, but I don't know. And then other stuff in between. Go to usafilmfestival.com for the complete schedule and finding out how to buy tickets and yada, yada, yada. But come to that. I'll be there. If you see me, say hey.
But only hey.
Just don't make eye contact.
then just walk away. Leave him as you found him. Empty.
We don't have tomorrow, but we have yesterday. All right. So, yes. By all means, join our club if you feel like it. We would love that. And check out our friends.
Oh, and when you come back from Dallas, we will be dropping the next Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
Right, yes.
The Darden Brothers.
Before the end of the month, we'll be doing Two Days, One Night. And we also have a club meeting coming up at the end of the month as well. Correct. So if you want to get in on that action, now's a good time to go join.
Yep.
And of course, in the meantime, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Gray and Matt, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Jaw Ryan thing, the Sewers of Paris, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Thank you to Blue for our wonderful theme music, and our friends of ours went to the Johnson and Macaulay show at the Hotel Cafe here and said it was really great.
Yeah.
So if you want to find out more about his new musical venture and all of his other great stuff, go to blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, and do leave us a review when you're there. It does help people find the show. Some of y'all have been doing that lately, and we greatly appreciate it. Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Thank you to Matthew and Allison and Alex and Almost Film Critic and RM and Light FM Gangsta and Jack and Other Jack and the 42nd Platypus and Jonathan and Matthew and Chris and Blamanda and Bianca and Michael for tweeting us this week.
Oh, wow. You counted all the tweets?
Yeah.
Thanks, tweeters.
Thank you, tweeters.
I'm on Twitter by myself as D. Leland White.
Yes, and I'm at A. Duraldi. And
I'm also on Instagram by myself as D. Leland White.
And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Drop us a line with questions or comments with your top 10 list. If you're a listener who's never written us before, tell us a little about yourself and what you like about the show and what you don't. If you have anything that you dare, tell us that you don't like.
There's nothing they don't like. The last time someone wrote us and told us about something they didn't like, well, there were two. There was one, turn off the ceiling fan.
Oh, right.
It's making a funny noise.
Which we did.
And you didn't care if we were comfortable or not. You just told us to turn off the ceiling fan. Also, the time when someone said that I dominated you in the conversation, which I have become very good about letting you speak. I'm so much better now.
You've gotten a little better.
I've gotten immensely better. This is now a show that stars you.
You are still Interruption Jones a lot of times.
Co-stars me.
Don't kid yourself.
Listen, sometimes when you're wrong, then all
bets are off. All right, it's been lovely. We will catch you guys next week. It will be a day late, but not a dollar short.
How much short will it be?
None. It will be all the dollars, just late.
But that's a certain amount of short.
It will be as good a podcast as ever, just not in a timely fashion. That's what I'm trying to say.
Listen, don't promise things. Don't go promising people things.
I will have Dallas stories to tell. It'll be great.
But will they be interesting Dallas stories? Listen. Don't come home unless you meet one of the Real Housewives.
I can't promise that. I don't know what they're up to.
You get FaceTime with what's-her-face, the volunteer, the charity
lady,
the charity coordinating lady, because she's going to be around.
If she comes to the festival, I will totally track her down.
You make sure you get on the internet, you memorize her face and her name, and when you see her, you go up and you tell her, why is your show so boring?
That's not going to be my conversation starter.
We were rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. And you are on a show that's boring that we don't actually want to watch.
If I can selfie her, I will put it on Instagram.
We watched the first episode of Real Housewives of Dallas for LKTV,
yes,
a podcast of the cinema. And we a podcast
of the television.
Of the television, pardon me. And we talked about it. It's terrible.
Spoiler.
Spoiler. It's a terrible show. It's boring. And I wish it were not.
Nobody gave them the memo that the Real Housewives is pro wrestling for women.
Yeah.
So what are you going
to do? In any case,
I'll be on the lookout.
Be on the lookout for her or any of the other ones. I know they're hard to tell apart because they're all blonde and the same looking in the face.
Yes.
But what are you going to do? White people all look alike.
Can we go now?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Goodbye.